Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mental Health Insights. My name is Craig, and today I'm here with Chad. I'm wondering, Chad, this is the first time they had you on, so can you just introduce yourself and tell everyone a little bit about you and the work that you do?
Yeah, so first of all, thanks for having me on. Definitely excited to be here. My name is Chad Welch. I'm a licensed clinical professional counselor in Illinois, in the Metro East. We're right outside of St. Louis. And I'm also a military reservist, an active reservist who practices on the side as well as kind of maintaining a military career.
I tell you what, a lot of people may not know this about therapy profession in general, but I feel like it's a profession that a lot of people do as like a second career. So it's so interesting for me always to hear what, unless you're someone like me who got in it, which... early on, which was, in my experience, I'm the minority. So it's so interesting to hear about things that people have done even before they got into this. Well, can you just tell me just a little bit, especially going into the military, what led you to wanting to be a counselor after you got done and now you're in the reserves?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I've been in private practice for about 6 years now, and I'm 48. So, definitely been an interesting path for me. Started off, actually joined the Marine Corps right out of high school when I was 18 and spent 4 years in. Got out of the military and started a career in corporate America. And then after September 11th, I wanted to get back in, and I was living right outside of Scott Air Force Base. So I called the recruiter, and I hopped back into the reserves at that standpoint. So I've deployed many times since then, kind of bringing me up to this point. But I guess it's 13 or 14 years ago now, I made the decision that I wanted to become a counselor. And so I started to take those steps and started to work that process. And I think what inspired me to be a counselor was from my military standpoint, I really had a good seat to kind of the struggles of military personnel in very stressful situations, and I also had a front row in the people that were able to help them through those times, the chaplains and the mental health professionals and the folks that were kind of embedded with us from a deployment standpoint. So it was just really inspirational to me to watch those professionals work and be able to carry people through those tough times. So I always thought that would be a good fit for me, and certainly glad I did that.
Well, it sounds like to me, first of all, that sounds so cool that for you being in a position where you can kind of see what other people are doing, like, hey, like that's maybe something I want to do as well, and actually stepping into it. I'm kind of wondering for you, like having this kind of background and already having this type of experience, right? A lot of people, they end up going into counseling because of experiences that they've had and that they kind of go through and then want to help other people with. You know, I can only imagine that if someone comes to you with, like different types of anxiety or trauma-like issues, that you're like, okay, I've got this. This is something that I've seen and experienced already in the careers that you've had before this. So I wonder for you, can you just tell me a little bit about what types of strengths do you feel that someone that has kind of gone through the military, what kind of strengths that they might have that they might be able to kind of bring to the world once they come back?
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting question because from a strength standpoint, I think that we bring in lots of different life experiences. Most of the folks in the military, at least people who've been in a long period of time, have a lot of kind of worldly experiences from a travel standpoint and being very culturally aware. Recently spent 400 days in the Middle East, and really the position that I held really allowed myself to really be immersed into that culture and very similar experiences in past deployments. So I think we bring in certainly a certain amount of maybe cultural awareness and relevance and real life experience that can be important in our work. The other thing I think we bring in is definitely high degrees of empathy, and I think this is probably on a personal basis. Not everyone brings that in, but from myself, just seeing what I've seen and experiencing what I've experienced, I really am able to connect with people from a empathetic standpoint, and I really feel that my military background has really helped me with that.
Yeah, I'm hearing you talk a little bit about this, and I'm kind of wondering, you know, if I'm a clinician that's listening to this. Like I told you before we started recording, right, we get both people that are listening to this, they want to understand mental health more. They want to kind of understand what's going on with them. And we also get clinicians that listen to this. So let's say first, if I'm a clinician that's listening to this, and maybe I really have a heart to work with those that are in the military, I really have a heart to work with veterans, what would you say is something maybe I should know that would be able to kind of help me with those types of, you know, that population?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking me that question, because it's really important to me, and I want to let clinicians know who maybe don't have any military experience that they're really highly needed in the military community, not only in the active and reserve community, but in the veteran community. And I think sometimes there's the impression from clinicians that military people only want to talk to military people, or the VA is going to take care of that, and that there's really not an opportunity for maybe private practice clinicians to be able to work with our population. And I'll tell you, from my deployment experience, when I was going through my reintegrations, and I talked to therapists myself, it was always private practice, people who did not have military experience. And that's how I wanted to work through my process of reintegrating back in after you know, coming in from deployed locations. So I think there's a real opportunity for clinicians to reach out. And I don't think it's really difficult. I think, you know, having a basic understanding of military culture and knowing just a little bit of the lingo, and then, of course, just that natural curiosity that I think makes great therapists in the first place. So even if you don't know any of that, just the willingness to be curious and understand a little bit about the culture and the background really makes you an asset to military folks. And I got to tell you, Craig, there's a huge need for non-military therapists to work in this community.
You know, I love that you said that, because I know even just for me, wanting to, like, I want to, and I have worked with different veterans over the course of my career, and I could see how that can be intimidating for different clients, or not clients, different therapists, rather, as far as like, well, if I don't have that specific background, or I don't have, you know, specific trainings. And so hearing you say that is, you know, for someone like me, I'm like, oh, well, that's great then. One of the things that I'm wondering is if we know, well, actually, can you talk to me a little bit about the military culture? See, I read a lot of books. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and a lot of the podcasts some of the podcasts I listen to are actually from people that are from the military and everything. So I feel like I have a pretty good handle a little bit on the culture. But I'm always open to learn, and I know that some people on here may not really know as much. So, like, if what should I know about the military culture that would kind of really help me to be able to bond with someone that has, you know, been in that type of culture?
Yeah. So, you know, the military is you know, absolutely a huge organization. So you've mm-hmm. got you know, probably literally hundreds of subcultures within probably the grand culture of the military cultural. So, you know, what does that look like? That's really hard to answer from the standpoint of you know, how long was someone in? What was their deployed experiences? What branch were they in? And I think there's so many questions that is that's a tough one to be concise. If I had to go really general on you, I would say that most people join the military for a variety of reasons. Some for the college money and some for patriotic reasons. But I think once you're on the team, it's being a part of a club, and there's some exclusivity to that as far as, you know, that's the way it's promoted. And, you know, hey, you're on our team, and we're the world's best Air Force, or we're the world's best Navy. And so you kind of got a lot of that kind of talk, and people, I think, generally are proud to serve. I think from another cultural standpoint is maybe where the general civilian population thinks of the military as more of a the mission is more of a war type mission, and of course that is one of the primary purposes. But the military has its hands in so many other pots, and from a humanitarian standpoint, all over the world there's humanitarian missions going on at the same time. And matter of fact, I would say generally, people in the military probably have more experience in that realm of things than they do with actually fighting wars. If I had to break down the population in general of the armed services, so it's a huge, diverse organization. Every race and from a multicultural standpoint, you'll find a little bit of everything in the military. I think from a societal standpoint, I think that the military is probably actually ahead of culture from the standpoint of accepting you once you put on that uniform. In general, I think most people feel like you're part of the team, no matter where you come from, what your background, what your religion, and even sexual orientation, which I think has really changed in probably the last 10 years. So I would say it's a very inclusive organization, which might be a surprise to some people.
Yeah, so one of the things I'm hearing you say is that if I'm a clinician that's maybe talking to someone in the military, that it would be good to honor that kind of status. That, like, hey, you are part of the club. Like, I may not be part of that club, but that's still okay. Like, we can still talk. But being able to honor that position and the different experiences that brings and the different integration that they've had with different cultures, different ways, different norms that may be different. There's always I just thought about this off the top of my head while I was listening to you. Being in the military is such an enormous, I guess, what's the word I'm trying to look for? It's such an enormous direction that you go, and the mission is very clear whenever you're in the military. And one of the things that I've heard before is that whenever, you know, you're a veteran that comes back to the States and you're reintegrating into society, really being able to have a mission to step into, really being able to have a role to step into, is something that's really helpful. And I'm just kind of wondering, even in the work that you do, or even if someone from the military is listening to this right now and maybe they're not sure what to do, can you just talk to me a little bit about that? Going from an organization where this is the direction that you're going, right? And you're instructed it, like when you go through boot camp, it's kind of nailed into you. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're back out into the world and kind of given any direction. Okay, so can you talk to me just a little bit about that? Like some people that are getting out, what's kind of a good first step for them, and what's something that's good for them?
Yeah. So first of all,
I feel like I hit you with a lot.
You did. Yeah. No sweat. So first of all, this concept of honor, and I think as therapists, we always want to honor wherever our client is coming from, and the military is no different, and being able to come to that from that position of being able to honor, but also not just stress the fact overly that, you know, this person has military service, maybe looking at it from a standpoint of that's part of who they are, but certainly not their complete definition. The second part of your question, I think, is really interesting. And as people transition, and most people we know, spend one term in the military, and that's usually anywhere from 2 to 6 years, depending on your branch and your commitment. So you have people transitioning out all the time, and you're absolutely right. So I've known people who come off deployment, where they're working, 15, 16 hour days on these, incredibly complex, vital missions. Maybe it's a humanitarian mission, or maybe it's a war mission, and they're feeling incredibly valued as part of the organization, and maybe they're feeling like they're making a huge difference in the world, and then all of a sudden their term ends, and they enter the civilian world again, and it can be a real shock from just a loss of purpose and maybe even relevance and being able to work with those folks to help them be able to kind of redefine themselves and find that purpose again. And it really makes me think of the work of Viktor Frankl and being able to find meaning and purpose is what Frankl said was kind of the center of his work. And I think that really maybe even applies a little bit extra to people that are transitioning out of the military.
That makes really good sense to me. I mean, if you're this, the only thing that I can kind of equate it to in my own experience, which is probably a very, very small and comparative, is that, you go through your entire school career and then basically they're like, all right, now you got to decide what you're going to do for the rest of your life. So you go through a period where people are telling you, this is what you get to do. Your goal is school, or your goal is to do all this. And then you get to the end of high school and they're like, okay, now you get to decide. Now you get to get picked. There's no multiple choice or anything like that. I imagine it's kind of like that on a much larger scale where it's, I get out and now what do I do? Now kind of where do I go?
Yeah. Yeah. And I joke with people sometimes and, go around a cemetery and take a look around and you'll see people who maybe lived to be 90 years old and they served in the military for maybe 2 to 4 years. But what's on their headstone, that's those service years. And you'll see that all over cemeteries. And, as people look back on their lives, I think, they tend to look back on that time period as such a purposeful, time. And I think one of the things we can be helpful, towards our clients is to help them in that transition. And certainly there's plenty of meaningful, life and meaningful work to be done after a service period.
So if I'm working with the veteran, and of course, like I'm, as therapists, we're trying to have a, collaborative relationship. So hopefully they're kind of giving me an idea and I'm having a good idea of some of the struggles that they're going through. I'm kind of wondering, I know that you said you work with some veterans. So what are some common struggles that maybe we haven't even talked about, besides just like the transitioning and figuring out, okay, what am I going to do now? And what's the purpose now? What are some other common struggles that they might face?
Yeah. So, one of the things maybe to start with is, maybe the most, common misperception is that, most of the people you work with that have a military background or maybe that are a veteran, probably have some sort of PTSD from their time in service that's untreated, and I think I hear this most as the most common misperception of what we really struggle with as service members and as veterans, and certainly there is that percentage of the population.
It's like if you served in the military, you must have PTSD.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's one of the things that can be really intimidating for mm-hmm. clinicians to work with. And, you've kind of got that image from the old Vietnam movies of guys coming back and mm-hmm. Being out of control.
Oh, like there must be, if I haven't found it in my assessment, what the trauma is, there must be something that I haven't found yet. So I might continue to kind of dig into that experience whenever that's actually not the right direction to look.
I think that's a great point. And I've, you know, I've consulted with other clinicians and I get that sense sometimes that, it's almost the default, is kind of hitting the PTSD button. Mm-hmm. But I think for the majority of us, it's what you see, in everyday life. I work with, a lot of couples. I do a lot of couples work in my practice. And, you know, so, it's relationship issues, it's family issues. Mm-hmm. From the military standpoint, you can put the twist on it of having to transition from place to place. Most people don't stay in a location any more than 3 years. So that can definitely add some challenges to the family and connecting into communities. And matter of fact, I'm working with a couple now that it has just been in the local area not so long. I think it's their seventh or eighth move in 13 or 14 years. And so that's a real challenge. If you can put yourself in that spot of moving not just streets or counties, but you know, moving geographic locations, sometimes into foreign countries, that can provide some challenge. So I think that transition management is huge when you work with a military population, and being able to recognize that and to assist with that. And as you alluded to, Craig, as far as the transitioning out, and you know, what does that look like? What does my new reality look like? And then of course you've got the basic anxiety and depression that probably most clinicians work with on a daily basis, and so you'll have just a little bit of everything, but if there's one takeaway from my part here, it's you know, please don't be too anxious to hit the PTSD button as soon as your vet walks in the door.
I love that you said that, especially because I'm hearing you talk about this, and like primarily one of the things I do is marriage counseling, and that's actually how I've been introduced to most of the, you know, any of the veterans that I've worked with. And the relationship issues are so multifaceted, because you go from someone that built these really close relationships with people that they worked with long hours, just like a lot of normal people might develop with, you know, coworkers that they have, except one of the main differences can be the bonding done in the military is different, because you guys all have to go through the same process, and the team can be a kind of very much like family for some people. And coming home and having an intimate relationship with someone else that didn't go through those experiences sometimes becomes a challenge. And it's only one aspect I'm thinking about, you know, as far as, like you said, what branch people came in, what some of the challenges that they're facing with transition. It's easy to develop different issues with bonding or relating to other people. And I never really thought of it that way until you talked about it. Like, you were part of this, you were part of the team, you were part of the people that were doing something, you're part of this mission, this cause. And then transitioning to, you know, out of that, or trying to kind of switch your mission and your direction towards your family or towards your spouse or anything, I imagine that has to be terribly difficult. Really challenging.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, the military has done a really good job of you know, really preaching family first, and really mental health has kind of been on the forefront here, you know, probably for the past decade. I think they've done a really good job of trying to open access and have that part of the norm. But you're absolutely right. And you know, I think that most clinicians can trace some kind of relational issue back to most of the work that they're doing with their clients, whether it's anxiety or depression, and even in some cases PTSD. But the relationships are really interesting to work with from a military standpoint. The other thing I want to plug there is if you work with couples, I think that's really where you have an edge as a civilian provider. I think that the military resources are really geared towards individual counseling and individual therapy, and there's really not a lot of resources for couples to come in and do work, military couples. So if you work with couples, I think there's a huge market for you to be able to work with military couples. There's a big need, and in my humble opinion, I think probably a lack of resources from that standpoint. So make yourself available, whether you have a profile on Psychology Today or however you advertise, just noting, military friendly, or some notation that's a client group that you're interested in working with. And I think sometimes that's all you need to do.
All right. Well, I'm wondering, and I'm kind of thinking about this from a 30,000 foot view, or maybe not quite that far. If I'm someone that's listening to this and like maybe I'm a veteran and I'm kind of on the fence about whether or not, I should go and talk to somebody or not. Can you tell me what would be, if I'm trying to decide, well, should I go through the VA or should I seek out a private practice clinician? What are some of the things I should be considering with that?
Yeah, so good question, and I'm going to split the group here because there's going to be two different needs. And so first of all, if you live by a military installation or you have populations of large either reserve, guard, or active duty members, I'm going to put that in one group, and then I'll address the veteran part later. And the veterans are the people who have already transitioned out of the military. So first of all, the active military group, there's never been a better time to be in private practice for this group of people. People who are active are concerned from the standpoint of talking to someone. If they were to obtain a specific diagnosis, this could adversely affect their careers. And maybe this is from a security clearance standpoint or from a limiting duty standpoint. Them seeking care on a base or in kind of a controlled environment, much preferred to go out into the civilian community to seek care. And I bring this up, and I think it's important because this is probably the main reason people or military folks don't seek care is because they are concerned that this may affect their career in a negative standpoint. So I think you got to be really careful with diagnoses and what codes you're using. And I specifically, I make sure we have that conversation when I'm working with active people. So the second group is veterans, and that's, I think that's a little bit easier to answer. I get a lot of people who have been through the VA system, and I'm definitely not going to sit here and knock the VA system. I think they have incredible resources and really can do some good work, but it's such a large organization. And the experiences that I've had with people coming in to see me have been people that feel like they've kind of gotten lost in the system and maybe they're not getting the individual care that they desire. So that's kind of the niche from a clinician standpoint, is being able to provide that individual care and that individual therapy, that 60-minute session or 45-minute session that you do, those are going to be a little bit harder for them to come by from a VA standpoint. And this is, again, not a knock on the VA from whatever the time and resources standpoint, and really the needs are probably too high for what they have to match. But again, I think there's been a nice movement to be able to open access for veterans to get into private practice folks and use the resources outside of the system. I think it's a real positive move.
I can't remember what the program it was, because I had a veteran couple that ended up using it, VA Care, or, oh gosh, Community Care, that's what it was, to where they were able to pick out their own clinician, and with the VA footing the bill for that.
Yeah, there's a move afoot on for that. There's also a wonderful program called Military One Source. If you are interested in that, you can you Google that and you can register as a clinician, and you'll get direct referrals from them. And basically this program allows service members to call in into an 800 number and then get matched up with a clinician. And in this case, there's no diagnoses or no paperwork. It allows them to have 12 sessions with you, and Military One Source foots the bill and takes care of it. I think we're starting to see the emergence of lots of those types of programs. And I think this generation is demanding different care than what my generation did, and even the generation before. They're demanding different and unique types of care, and I think we're finally responding to that. So again, it's a great time if you're a clinician to get out there and work with that veteran population.
Well, I just want to rewind even to something that you said before, and it's so important. I didn't even think about this when we were having this conversation about how a mental health diagnosis can impact a military career. Like even something, I recall a conversation with a friend about how he had to be really careful, because if he went to go see a clinician, he got some type of anxiety diagnosis that could adversely affect him, whether or not he's able to be deployed or not, what kind of advancement opportunities he'd have. So he actually didn't seek care because of that. And I guess until you just mentioned it right there, I hadn't really considered like how big a deal that might have been.
It's a huge deal. And again, if you're dealing with anyone who's still active, and that, and I'm including Guard and Reserve folks in there as well, that has got to be a consideration, through care. And this is not me saying to give an improper diagnosis code, but I would just be really upfront with that part and ensuring that, military personnel knows what's going on. I use a lot of the F43.20, right, which is the adjustment disorder with anxiety or depression, and I think it's a valid diagnosis for a lot of folks, and we're working with hopefully a short time frame, maybe 12 to 15 sessions to work through the issue. And I find most of the time that's the case. And the more severe cases, probably should be referred out. But for probably 95% of the folks that you'd be seeing, that a clinician would be seeing from an active standpoint, it's probably a pretty safe road to go down there from a career standpoint.
Yeah, I know that other... I mean, I know there are other occupations that suffer that same type of, where they had to be careful about that too. Like I know certain, police organizations or, EMS, like sometimes they had to be careful of that kind of thing too.
Yeah. And I also want to make clear, cause I certainly don't want to come off that if someone is a threat to themselves or to others, you don't properly diagnose. So that's certainly not what I'm saying. Looking out for your client's safety, and the safety of their loved ones and the people that they work with is always the first priority in my experience. Though we can become so overly cautious that we dissuade them from getting help and care, just from the absolute petrified fear of losing their career, losing their livelihood, losing their health insurance, because they went and talked to, a marriage counselor about, working through a tough situation that they had. So, I certainly want to make sure I'm clear on that part of it.
Yeah. I think when you're talking about it, I didn't get the impression that you're like, hey, don't diagnose or anything like that. That wasn't the impression I was getting. But I definitely think that it does present a unique opportunity for private practice clinicians, like you said, being able to be there and maybe even giving a little more time for assessment, you know, not hitting the PTSD button right away not hitting a certain diagnosis right away, especially since some diagnosis can actually be treated very quickly, whereas trauma takes a little longer, right? But I think that sometimes those conversations don't get had in the offices. I think you're right. That's one of the reasons why, you know, maybe kind of looked down upon. I wonder, in your experience, you know, if I'm someone that's a veteran that's listening to this, what would be some of the obstacles that I might be facing as far as receiving care that we might not have even talked about so far?
Yeah, so maybe the obstacles, if you're a veteran listening to this, are if you're active, it's, again, the fear of a diagnosis affecting your career. And I think we addressed that. And, you know, so I'd encourage you to talk to your clinician and be really upfront about that and what's going on. And maybe that will help. You know, other obstacles are we still have some of that stigma as much as we've tried to work through that. And I think there's in my experience and the roles that I've had, the military has really put its best foot forward to try to eliminate the stigma, but, it's still there. And as it is in general society. So I think your limitations, if you're an active service member, are maybe your own perceptions and your own views on what is and is not counseling or therapy and how it may be able to assist. Like I said, after each one of my deployments, I've always gone and sought counseling and therapy, and usually it's 6 to 8 sessions, and it's just been a huge benefit. And more and more military people are willing to do that and willing to talk about it. So, if you're a younger service member, you know, talking with a trusted NCO or supervisor about what's going on and getting their thoughts on that, having them help you through that process to find someone to talk to. The second part, you know, from the veteran standpoint, is maybe a little bit more complicated. What would stop you from going to see someone? And it could be probably the same list of what would stop a regular civilian from lack of health insurance or resources, or just maybe that I don't need help, and I'm not raised that way, and from a military standpoint, you know, we have that part of that culture is also, you know, joining the club and making it in the club. This is where it may work against us from a cultural standpoint is that you know, sometimes we get the impression that you know, we're bulletproof and we shouldn't need that. We should be able to work through our own issues. And again, it's always a push and pull on that. And I think we've struggled with that as a service, to let you know you can still be in the club and get help at the same time.
What a wonderful message right there. And, I think if there's anything that I'm taking away from this, and I love even how you just said that last thing, is that, they'd probably have the same type of challenges that anyone else in the civilian world would, is getting help. And this is kind of something that you've reiterated over this, and me as a clinician hearing this is something that's really important, and which is why I want to continue to emphasize it, that just because someone's been in the military doesn't mean that they are so different that we should look at them totally different than anyone else that we're helping. The military piece is something to honor, and it's something to maybe talk about as a reference, but it's not always the whole entire encompassing part of their life. You know, for some people, it may be a footnote to their story that they have so far, and other people, it may be the little bit larger piece. And I think that sometimes whenever you're right, whenever someone's working with someone that's a veteran, or maybe even veterans themselves, because I've had this experience too, where they just assume that they might have a certain type of diagnosis. I've had a couple veterans that have come to me and they're like, I have PTSD, and they actually didn't have PTSD. But that's the message that we get all the time, is that there must be something going on with me, or there must be something wrong. And I feel like that those go through the military, those that are kind of looking from the outside, looking in, they always hold that assumption. And if there's anything I'm hearing you say, that's not the case.
As clinicians, and you, Craig, you mentioned about the kind of the intimidation factor, and I think we could put that on any group that you may work with. That's maybe a group that you hadn't worked with. I think there's always a little bit about that, but for the clinicians listening, I encourage you to push through that and to work with that. And you're absolutely right. The array of problems that everyone else has, you're gonna see the exact same thing, maybe with a little twist here and there from a military perspective. But it is, we're not talking Mars and Venus here. We're talking maybe the left side of the street to the right side of the street. So definitely want to encourage clinicians to be open to that. And again, the need has never been greater, as we, have been to war coming up on 20 years, and the amount of folks who have cycled through the Middle East, over coming up on 1 million Americans, I think I just recently read, who have spent time in some kind of war zone. So your role as a clinician and being able to really be able to reach out to that community and do some great work, I think is pretty clear.
So, I've been thinking about this question, for a little bit, and, I just from my own experience working with veterans, what would you say is the most fun or unique part about it? I know for me, I love the humor that most of my veterans have. I love the humor, and I love the quick wit give and take, which, as I understand, you kind of have to have that in order to be in the military at times. You have to be able to kind of give and take a lot.
Yeah.
So I love that part. But I also love that if I ask, this is just most of the veterans I've worked with, if I ask them to do something outside of session, there's about a 95% chance that they're going to do it. Like the follow through is incredible. And this is some of the things that I love working with veterans that I don't always get working with, like the civilian population or anything. So kind of tell me, what are some of the things that maybe you love about working with veterans that, make you smile or anything while you're in session?
Yeah. You had mentioned the homework part of it, and, I had a session just in the last few days, and this lady was, so what do I need to do in between our sessions? I'm like, I'm nothing I can think of at this point. And, she's like, no, you need to assign me something to do in between our sessions. Do you have a worksheet? Do you have, I'm like, all right, yeah, let me, I'll email you something. And I did. So you're absolutely right. You're going to get some good compliance, typically from the military, community. Of course, the kind of the quick wit and the sense of humor, I think, I'll echo that, as well. The thing that I'll add, would be that, again, and bringing this thing full circle a little bit, is talking about this sense of purpose, and this meaning, and again, going back to the reason why I think most people join the service, and although the college money sounds good and some of the other benefits, I think intrinsically most people are there to make a difference and to and to get some meaning in their life and purpose. And I think that's what I enjoy most about working with the military and veteran community is that generally very purpose and meaning centered people. And if you can help them move into that spot, I think that you really have the potential to do good work with them.
So that's actually a good question. I think this a good question that just came up to my head. What do you do, or how do you help people find purpose? If they're coming to see you, and this can be anybody, doesn't necessarily have to be the military community or anything like that. How do you help someone find purpose when they're coming to see you?
You know, I think it's about being able to help them work through kind of their own self-assessment of, first of all, of values and kind of what they hold dear to themselves. And a lot of people will give you kind of the standard answers, the things that they're supposed to say. And you know, maybe, well, my family's the most important thing.
So you're pretty good at picking up on that when they're saying the things that they're supposed to say.
Yeah. But, you know, and I think, you know, that's all about, as a good clinician, you know, being able to establish that rapport and being able to, you know, to work through that. So I don't think this is a one session thing, but, you know, I think it's about really honestly finding what their values are and what they value most and what kind of, you know, makes their heart race a little bit faster or takes their breath away a little bit as they think about that. And then gearing, you know, gearing that part of the conversation towards what's actually happening in their lives. And I read somewhere, and I don't recall exactly where it was, but the clinician described the mental health issues being the gap between our values and our actions. And I think there's a lot to that. So, you know, what's going on in your life, and what are your actions, and are they lining up with who you say you are and who you want to be? And of course, this is done with tons of empathy and rapport and that personal relationship that you develop to connect with your clients, so they have that safe space to be able to explore that. You know, someone says that fitness is really important and they don't get off the couch the first session. I'm not going to point that out to them, right? It's, we're going to work with that.
After a little bit, well, you know, it seems to be really hard for you to get off the couch.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I'll tell you what, I find myself really not having to go there. Where I'm the one saying it seems like it's really hard for you to get off the couch. I think when you're doing good work, your clients start saying, you know, I'm not getting off the couch, and these things are not matching up. My values and my actions aren't matching up here. So,
is it called, like, this is what it's called when I was going through school, the real versus ideal self.
Yeah.
All right. You're talking about that article. I wish I could remember, because I feel like I read that same article.
Yeah. And it might have been a book too. And I'm sure you're like me. I'm certainly self-inundated with articles and podcasts and lots of things I really just enjoy being filled up with. But I think from our client standpoint, it's creating a space where they can be comfortable exploring the ideal self to the real self, right? And closing that gap a little bit.
So you guys can't see this because this isn't a video, but whenever I asked Chad this question, he lit up. I get the feeling that that's something you like, helping people find their purpose or what it is that they want.
Yeah. Life. You know, I'm a big Viktor Frankl fan, you know, the book Man Search for Meaning is a book I've read, you know, dozens of times, and I recommend it to many of my clients, you know, Frankl's work, I think I could sum it up with saying that, I think he said something like 90% of the people he worked with could be cured. Cured in quotes by finding meaning and purpose. And so having that as an ideal and being able to work with your client towards that goal. And I think you can also do that in conjunction with work addressing anxiety or depression or even PTSD. So helping your clients find meaning and purpose is not a separate therapy. I think you do that in conjunction with maybe other techniques. And I think when Frankl designed what I think became known as existential therapy, it's an umbrella that you can fit CBT in there or basic Gottman couples work or whatever work that you do. I think you can find it, you can fit it under the umbrella of some form of existentialism and being moving toward and helping your clients move towards that that sense of meaning and purpose.
I think you're right, and that a lot of people, the challenges that they face, the underlying thing is that things just aren't quite matching up, and it is an existential kind of rub, or it doesn't feel quite right. Like even I think of and you probably see this with your couple's work, and I see it with my couple's work too. A lot of the challenges that couples face, things aren't going the way that they thought they were going to, or the way that they planned, and the things that they're doing just aren't working with each other a lot of times because they have a slightly different set of values or a large set of set of values or expectations of how things are going to go, and trying to adjust is really hard. It's really difficult. And not only that, then you get hit with these other messages that maybe they don't love me, maybe they don't care about me, maybe I'm not important with them. So then that hits the existential thread right there. Well, maybe other people don't care about me as much either. Maybe, maybe I need to find someone that does care about me, or maybe other people care about me, or maybe they don't, or maybe no one cares about me. And I feel like it can kind of, like it starts to kind of play a symphony for you there after a while. And it leads to some of these conditions that we actually end up diagnosing. But I kind of think about that. I don't know if you end up kind of playing that in your head whenever you're meeting with somebody or after you get done. Like, I wonder what it is that is kind of bringing this on. Like, what is the path that they went on in their life that finally kind of led them to this kind of conclusion or anything? For me, even just thinking about it right now, it's kind of like those two things are married, right? The experiences that we have and, even just going back to that whole conversation about the real versus ideal self, all the experiences that we have that we're kind of comparing to what we're wanting and then we're found for lacking creates a really difficult dichotomy to bridge. So like hearing you even light up when you talk about like, hey, like helping people find their purpose. I wonder whenever you kind of help people move towards that direction, what do you see in them? What do you see happen to the client that's sitting in your chair that is kind of taking a step in that direction towards kind of discovering what their purpose is or what it is that they want?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say, you talked about this in context of couples work, and I can't think of a better format than couples work to work some of this meaning and purpose. And it's one thing kind of working it out with you as a therapist, but also being able to have their partner there to be able to support that and also maybe as a little bit of an accountability partner as well when it's done in a healthy way. So I really love couples work when we're able to get down in this type of meaning. And what was the second part?
So whenever you see maybe an individual or a couple kind of move a little bit closer to what they kind of feel like that purpose is, what do you see happens to them? How do they respond whenever they start to kind of get closer to it?
Yeah. And that's, to me, it's
there's a smile again.
Yeah. Well, it's the most rewarding part of being a clinician. And sometimes it's a matter of weeks and months and, kind of being patient with the process. But what great fun it is as a clinician to watch people start to make these changes. And I joke with my longer term clients that and I'm sure clinicians out there can relate to this, you can almost, people that you've been with for a long time, as soon as you open that waiting room door, you can almost, you almost sense kind of where they're at. And so when people, I think, are moving towards their meaning and their purpose, you know, when I open that waiting room door, you know, maybe it's a story I'm making up in my head, but you can almost watch the bounce in the step and the kind of the way they walk into the therapy room, kind of excited for the next round and what's going to happen next. And it becomes now an exciting journey versus this dreaded therapy. Let's, you know, talk about how my mom screwed me up and talk about all these bad things. And so you flip the script, but I think you flip the script on therapy and you make it an exciting journey. And when people start moving towards that, I think that's the response you start getting. And it just, it brings the energy, in the room up. I think it certainly does on mine. We feed off each other's energy as clinicians and our clients do as well. And boy, when we're in one of those sessions, it's just a high energy situation. And that hour just cooks by and it's a great feeling.
I think that, what you said is 100% accurate to my experience as well. Like whenever people, I think people can actually feel this, like people that are even non-clinicians that may be listening to this, right? Whenever you're around somebody that kind of has their purpose in the crosshairs, you can feel it. You can feel it kind of radiating off them, right? The person that is, going towards their purpose, you know, they're not the downtrodden person that, is feeling really bad or really sad or anything. Not to say that that doesn't happen sometimes, but whenever you feel like someone's kind of really in that direction, they're heading towards it, energy just comes off them. And I think you're right. Those are really cool sessions for us as clinicians, but I can only imagine, and I think that, you know, sometimes we do get that you open the door and you get this person that is like, they are one step closer and you can feel it. And then sometimes they, you know, open the door and they've stumbled on that step. And then you kind of get that person come in and trying to help them continue to take those steps or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I think that energy, like you said, is the best way of describing it. And the excitement and a mixture of, I'm having a mixture of things right now because I'm thinking of whenever I've had this experience and then one of my clients have had this experience, right? So a little bit of a transference and counter transference going on there. But whenever like the fear and the excitement kind of get to mix together with it.
Yeah.
And I think that in some way or another, I believe that's why most people step into that therapy room.
Yeah, and we could almost do a whole nother podcast just on energy and I'm a huge believer in it, and I'll tell you, I'm really cognizant of when I open that door, they're gonna pick up on my energy and it's gonna be a big smile and a big greeting and I'm gonna start that session off. Now we may not maintain that energy depending on what's going on, and this isn't me not being able to adjust, but I think it's important for a clinician to bring that and offering that to your client as something that they can feed off of. I find a lot of my clients, I'm the only person that's like that in their lives. You know, everything else is so negative, and I've been told this, you know, you come in and you're the only one that's happy to see me and excited about our work, and I just live this boring life. So I think that's important to keep in mind as clinicians. I bring that energy, or at least I attempt to every one of my sessions.
It's almost like you got to remind them that they're the hero of their story.
That's a great way of putting it.
And I think that, I mean, that says a little bit of something about the kind of clinicians that we can be, right? We can be those type of people that are giving off that kind of energy, giving off that kind of greeting, right? That we are happy to see you, and I think that sometimes whenever we start to get a little burnt out, or maybe we get a little bit lazy with it, we don't give off that signal, and our clients pick up on that. Just like we can pick up whenever they're excited, I think they can pick up whenever we're like, hopefully things are going to go well today. So even just us rewinding and going back to the purpose conversation. Now, I'm sitting here, I've been wondering kind of in the background while we've been having this conversation, you know, if I'm someone that's starting to kind of wonder, like, do I know my own purpose? Do I know the purpose of my life, or do I know the direction that I'm wanting to go? If I'm someone that's listening to this, I'm wondering those type of questions. I wonder, what are some things that maybe you and I can just kind of brainstorm right here? What are some things that maybe I should be asking myself, or maybe would kind of point me in the right direction? And even as I just come up with that question, I know the first thing that I think that we've kind of already touched base on is that, like, if I start to think about it, I probably get excited going in the direction of whatever my purpose is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, kind of the way I described it earlier, as far as the thing that kind of maybe quickens your heartbeat just a little bit, or takes a little bit of your breath away, but it also doesn't have to be that dramatic. And you know, what are those things? And sometimes it's just about, I think, you know, being willing to experiment with things that maybe you haven't tried for a while. I tell you, I absolutely love the therapeutic intervention of recommending doing some volunteer work watching the effect that has on people who are just being able to put themselves in a position of serving others, mm-hmm. in a small way, being able to big exercise guy, big love exercise myself, and being able to have people start in that direction, and I think these are foundational things that help you move in the direction of being able to figure out what that purpose is, and, you know, why am I here, and what's the meaning of my life, what is my time best used doing, so, you know, I think those are a couple things that come to my mind.
So having an experimental mindset. So if I'm listening to this, I'm like, okay, what maybe do I need to do? I need to be experimental, and maybe experimental with things that are very different than what I'm used to.
Yeah. Right?
Whether or not it's doing community service, or I like to always think of the things that you're kind of a little scared of, or that you're uncomfortable with, would be a big thing. I know, I don't know if you're like this or not. I know a lot of people that have on this podcast, I think I told you this before this, they're usually pretty nervous, right? When they come, right? They're actually, and that's one of the things I love about therapists is therapists, since they tell their clients, like, hey, like, you got to do things that are kind of scary or maybe uncomfortable. So therapists inherently have to make themselves do it too. I feel like that's the same way for people that are looking for their purpose, that you're not going to find purpose in a comfortable zone.
Yeah.
It has to be something that you're a little bit scared of. It's uncomfortable. It's not something that you're really used to.
Yeah.
So if you're experimenting, you have to include that in that experimentation zone.
Yeah.
What you're willing to do.
Yeah. You know, there's a leadership quote that I've kind of flipped on its head to make it a what type of therapist I want to be. And it goes something like, I'm here to make the uncomfortable comfortable and comforted, and I'm also here to make the comfortable a little bit more uncomfortable, and I think that goes in really well with, you know, with what you're saying, and it's about knowing where your client's at, and maybe some of this work you need to do some other things to prep people for this type of work, and not every client that walks in the door is you know, is ready to be uncomfortable. But I think ideally, hopefully you're able to help them move into that spot, of comfort, so you can now then prod them to be uncomfortable again. And that's what growth is all about.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sitting here thinking of, good things always have to come in three, right? I feel like we only got a list of two. something tells me that I know that for me personally, whenever I am trying to go in the direction of what I feel like my purpose is, I have to tell people about it. I don't have to tell people the full story, but I have to tell people about it. Like there's inherent risk in that. And I think that also people kind of provide you with the feedback of whether or not like you're going in the right direction, right? If people are like, I don't know about that, or I don't know what that's like. Like for me, that's usually like, okay, that means that's kind of the direction that I probably need to go. Then,
yeah.
Right. If it's uncomfortable for me and it's a little bit uncomfortable for them, like that's probably a pretty good thing.
Sure.
Then I know that if I tell people something that, and they get really excited about the thing that I do, then I know it's golden. Then I know that that's something that I should be doing and that's going in that direction, as long as their excitement isn't more than mine.
Sure. Right? Sure.
So I kind of feel like, but I know that that's for me. So I kind of want to get your gauge on that, about my idea of maybe the third one kind of being like a social component, like talking to people about it, about what you feel like your purpose is or what you feel like the direction of it would be.
Yeah, kind of what comes up for me as you're talking about that is, we mentioned it just a little bit earlier, is this concept of an accountability partner. And when we do couples work, it's, you know, typically our partner. So I think there's a component of that is just very powerful. So we'll bring it total full circle now and talk and bring back in our military conversation. And if you think about how, you know, how do we bring in this 18-year-old kid that maybe hasn't had any responsibility in their lives, and in 12 weeks we turn them into this completely new, responsible, high-speed, skilled soldier or airman or marine or sailor that's able to accomplish these wonderful things and is done as a team, and is done from the social part that you're mm-hmm. talking about, and we push each other, and there's a good reason that basic training is not an individual sport. You basically go in with 100 guys or gals into your section, your platoon that you work with, and really the magic is going to happen within that group. It's not going to be the two or three drill instructors that are pushing you. It's going to be the entire group that ends up holding you accountable, pushing you, and helping you grow past limits that you didn't think were possible. So I love your number three. I think you're onto something there.
Okay. I think that me even just thinking about the social component, hearing you say that, and kind of talking about that, bringing it full circle, as you said, which you're totally right, you did. I'm wondering if that's, the military, first of all, accomplishes all three of those things that we talked about. So it makes sense that it gives people a sense of purpose. So if you're someone that's listening to this, and you're like, hey, this purpose thing that they're talking about, that sounds awesome. Like, I want to feel excited. I want to feel that energy just come off me. I want to feel, I want other people to notice it about me. And then I would have to talk to other people about it. I'd have to be willing to experiment and kind of like push that out. And I would have to kind of be able to go in the direction of whatever excites me, whatever it is that I want to do. I want to kind of differentiate for a second. The excitement, I think, that we're talking about, I want to borrow what you said. It's the thing that like where like your heart starts to beat a little faster, or starts to flutter or anything. All right. I can think about $1 million and I start to get a little bit excited. Right. But that's not the same.
Sure.
It's not the same level. So I think that that'd be a easy way for someone to get tripped up. So it's the kind of excitement that, maybe you got with whenever you took a glance over at your first crush, or it's the excitement that you get. That's not when you're lustful towards something, whenever you just like, you know, the thing you're staying up thinking about all the time, or maybe it's kind of at the edge of your consciousness all the time.
Yeah.
So those would be kind of like the three things.
Yeah.
Right. Unless you can think of a fourth, I don't know.
Man, I think we're good with three. Yeah.
I think those are pretty good. so I want to thank you for coming on here, Chad, and talking with me about this. I know that the energy conversation, maybe that's one we'll have again in the future.
Yeah,
I do like that. And I know that a lot of clinicians and a lot of people, they feel energy very, very real, just like any other sensation that we are able to have. And I know this conversation that we had here, I know while it was about the military and reaching veterans, I feel like this applies to most anyone, right? Being able to honor the pieces of people and their past and their history and what's kind of made them who they are. And there is great need in the military community, just like there's great need in community as well. And they're not a population that clinicians should shy away from, right? They're a population that are kind of ready for clinicians to kind of, you know, do that even handshake, right? And to kind of step into that world. So again, I want to thank you for coming on here and talking with me about that. And then us even going into the conversation about purpose, which that was a conversation that got me excited too. Just in general, those are always conversations I enjoy having. I know those are conversations people enjoy listening to as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, thanks. Thanks for having me on, and hopefully we can do it again. And you know, just in my closing thoughts, if you're a civilian clinician, you know, make an effort on however you advertise your services to let people know. Just let folks know, military and veterans, that that you're friendly towards them, that you want to work with them. You don't have to understand everything. You don't have to get it all. That's not even close to what's needed. If you're if you're a vet out there or an active duty service person that needs some help, grab it. And it has done nothing but been wonderful for my career. I've never shied away from it. If you're an NCO or an officer, talk to your younger folks about this, and let them know that it's all right to get help. And I think we'll all be better in the clinician as well as the vet world.
Well, I wanted to say this because I don't think we actually said it on air. Can you just tell people about your practice, where you're located? Because you said you're really close to Scott Air Force Base, right?
Yeah. So our practice is called Metro East Counseling. The website is www.mymetroeastcounseling. You'll be able to find me on there, as well as the clinicians that we have working in the office. We have 6 clinicians working in the office, and we're all independent. We share living space, and we collaborate and have a supportive environment, but everyone kind of does their own thing. So we certainly would love to hear from you there. You can hit me up on our website or on our Facebook page, and we're certainly glad to help you out or point you in the right direction, or if you just want to have a conversation, would love to hear from you.
All right, sounds wonderful. And thank you everyone for joining us for this episode of Mental Health Insights. Until next time, we wish you well. Thank you for listening to our show. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and reliable information, and those that appear on the show are all licensed professionals in the area of mental health counseling. We are in no way rendering legal or medical advice, only information to help serve you better in making decisions in your life. If you need a professional, you should find one. The music you are listening to is called Lobby Time, and that is by Kevin MacLeod and licensed through Creative Commons.